Good afternoon, everybody. I flew in over Lexington and was reminded of how gorgeous this countryside is. I spent a week actually bicycling through Kentucky 30 years ago from Oberlin, where I went to school, to Nashville, where I worked after graduating for a while, and got to know a little bit of the countryside here. My brother was actually born in Kentucky. When my father, when my parents were here, my father was in the Army doing research. And we think about the value of research in changing people's lives around the world and around the state. I want you to picture in your mind a person who you know who's had a heart attack or a stroke, and a person who you know who's had cancer. At least half of all of the heart attacks, strokes, and cancers in this country and in this world could be prevented with easy, inexpensive interventions that are available to us today. So at least one of those two people who you pictured didn't have to go through that. The biggest challenge for health research, for public health, and for clinical medicine moving forward is how to be as one program focused on improving health status, whether we do that from the public health department, from the university, from the clinical provider, from the community health center, from the pharmacy, from the school, from the workplace. That's our biggest challenge in health today, and health is our biggest challenge in this country today. So that is our number one challenge. And health services research can be very important in helping us to address that challenge. Now, what this slide shows is what I just said. If you look at three of the leading causes of death in the U.S., cardiovascular disease, cancer, and unintentional injuries, at least half, that's a rough estimate, but at least half of each of those conditions is preventable with current technologies. And if you look at how we're doing compared to the rest of the world, this is quite interesting, because if you just focus for a bit on the blue bars, that was just 15 years ago. We were better than a couple, not much worse than many, but over the past 15 years, the world has kind of left us in the dust. They have significantly reduced conditions that are preventable through healthcare, deaths from conditions preventable through healthcare, and we have not. The result of that is that we are making much slower progress than other countries. And the result of that is that chronic diseases are the leading cause of death and disability in the U.S. 1.7 million deaths per year, half of all Americans have one or more chronic conditions, and more than three quarters of all healthcare costs. And what you see is that this is not sustainable in our society. The number of Medicare beneficiaries continues to increase, and the number of workers per beneficiary continues to decrease. Medicare is dealing with the results of failure to prevent and effectively treat high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, and more. And as Nacho has said, not only is our health status poor, but our inequalities are very large. Inequalities in health status are large, persistent, and increasing. Poverty, income, and wealth inequality, poor quality of life, racism, sex discrimination, and low socioeconomic conditions are the major risk factors for ill health and health inequalities. African Americans have a lower life expectancy than white Americans by 4 to 7 years for females and males. And heart disease is the leading single cause of that difference in life expectancy, with cancer number two. The factors that affect health are at the base the socioeconomic factors that determine the structure of our society: poverty, education, housing, inequality. One level above that are things that change the context and make the default decision the healthy decision, whether that's clean water or iodized salt or smoke-free air or 0 grams trans fat or tobacco taxes that are high. This makes the default decision healthy. One level above that are long-lasting preventive interventions like immunizations or brief intervention for problem drinking or colonoscopy or tobacco cessation. One level above that are clinical interventions, things that require the healthcare system to work day in and day out all year long: treatment of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. And at the top level is counseling and education, encouraging people to eat healthy, be physically active. This is not to say that we should only do one or another level, although the impact of these interventions tends to be largest at the bottom and smallest at the top. But for any health program, there are interventions that have the potential to make a difference at every level of intervention. Our challenge is to identify the areas where we can make a difference and then systematically and objectively work to improve health in those particular areas. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, we identified 6 key areas where we think we can make a really big difference. And I'll go through those one by one. Tobacco use remains the leading preventable cause of death in the U.S. Tobacco will kill more than 1,000 people today and every day this year. It will cost our healthcare system more than $100 billion. And it will expose more than half of our children to secondhand smoke. And yet we know what to do. We're making progress. Fewer people smoke now than have ever smoked before as a proportion. Smoke-free laws are expanding. We began running tips from former smokers, a hard-hitting ad campaign on tobacco. How many people in this room have seen the ad campaign? It's pretty good. We estimate that by the time the 12-week campaign finishes, 90% of smokers will have seen the ad at least 10 times, one ad at least 10 times. This is the first national advertising campaign against tobacco paid for by any part of the federal government. The budget for this campaign is less than what the tobacco industry pays in 2 days for marketing and promotion. So we're getting outspent in 2 days, outspent for our entire year in 2 days of tobacco industry marketing and promotion. And yet, this campaign will be very successful because we have truth on our side and we have real people's stories on our side. I heard earlier from officials here in Kentucky that calls to the quit line in Kentucky have increased fivefold since the ads began running. And we did not put the quit line number on most ads because we were afraid of overwhelming the quit lines. So this is an example of the kind of big difference that can be made. You see here graphs of the California experience and the New York City experience, where smoking has declined by more than a third, teen smoking by more than half. Teen smoking in the leading jurisdictions in the U.S. is now at 7%, one-third the national average of about 20%. So progress definitely possible. Nutrition, obesity, food safety, and physical activity, also critically important, a huge burden. Someone who is obese costs the healthcare system on average $1,700 more per year to care for. One in six people in the U.S. get sick every year from foodborne illness, and foodborne illness costs a lot. A single case of E. coli 0157 can cost $7 million. And we've made progress. In some age groups, we've seen declines in obesity. New York City, through a comprehensive approach, has rigorously documented in hundreds of thousands of school kids a decrease in obesity of 6%, actually a decrease of 10% in the younger age groups. We're not sure what caused that, but we are seeing progress in various jurisdictions around the country. And E. coli 0157 infections decreased by half in the past 14 years through a collaboration with industry and public health. Healthcare-associated infections affect 1 in 20 hospitalized patients. They cost about $30 billion a year. And if you look at just one particular problem, Clostridium difficile, which we recently published an update on, nearly all infections are from the healthcare setting, and about 14,000 Americans die each year as a result of complications of C. difficile. And yet we're seeing real progress with steady declines in central line infections and other infections. So again, a winnable battle, an area where we can make a difference. Motor vehicle injuries, 33,000 deaths a year, 3 million ED visits a year, the number one cause of injury death and the number one cause of death in Americans age 1 to 45. $100 billion in healthcare and economic costs, but we have made progress. Nearly a 25% decline over the past few years in motor vehicle fatalities through a wide variety of efforts, including expansion of ignition interlock devices and expansion of graduated driver's licenses, making it safer for kids to learn to drive without endangering themselves, their friends, and other drivers and pedestrians. Teen pregnancy. 1,000 teens give birth every day in this country. 1 out of 11 new mothers is a teen. Our rate of teen pregnancy is 9 times higher than the rate of other countries. And the cost to taxpayers is about $9 billion every year. And more than that, teen pregnancy condemns the next generation to not living up to their full potential and represents often the intergenerational transmission of poverty. We are seeing progress, not nearly enough, but progress with a 17% drop in teen pregnancy in recent years. So these are areas where we're making progress and we can make much more progress. HIV, we still have 1.2 million people living with HIV and 1 in 5 of them don't know they're infected. Only about 1 in 4, 28% of people with HIV have their viral load suppressed. That means that nearly 3 out of 4 are not getting effective treatment. And the virus is raging through their body, destroying their immune system, increasing the risk of cancer, and increasing the risk of infecting their partners, their families, and their communities. The lifetime cost of caring for one person with HIV is $400,000. You can buy a lot of condoms for $400,000 to prevent HIV. We are making some progress. 11 million more Americans know their status than knew it just a few years ago. And we need to make even more progress helping people learn their status and get into care and stay in care. Heart disease and stroke are leading killers in the U.S. There are 2 million heart attacks and strokes per year in this country, 700,000 deaths per year from heart attack and stroke. 1 in 3 deaths is from heart attack or stroke, many of them in younger individuals. And the conditions are costly, about $444 billion a year in healthcare and economic costs. There's a lot that we can do to reduce cardiovascular disease, and that's why last year, in conjunction with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we launched the Million Hearts campaign. We think we can prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes in the next 5 years, now 4 years, with very focused interventions. What we can do is, on the one hand, to reduce the need for care through tobacco control interventions, improvements in diet and nutrition, such as the elimination of trans fat and reduction of sodium, and by improving care of people who are in need of care for high blood pressure and high cholesterol. And I think the several ways we've seen of improving clinical care involve, first and foremost, looking at the numbers, getting everyone to focus on key outcome indicators. What proportion of your patients have their blood pressure controlled? We want every doctor, nurse practitioner, advanced practice nurse in America to know the answer to that question. Whether they're an obstetrician, an orthopedist, primary care practitioner, to know what proportion of their patients have their blood pressure under control, because right now nationally, it's at 46%. And even for people in care, it's not much over 60%. But the best performing health systems can get it up to 85 to 90%. That difference is the difference between 2 million heart attacks and strokes a year and 1.5 million heart attacks and strokes a year. It's a 500,000 Americans. If you think back to that person you thought of at the very beginning with a heart attack or stroke, who don't have to have a heart attack or stroke. The second major initiative in clinical care is health information technology. We're still in the dark ages, but we're rapidly emerging from them. We're rapidly able to increase availability of information before the visit, during the visit, and after the visit, not just for the doctor, but for the entire healthcare team that has a role in patient care and a right to have that information, and for the patient, because we need to free up that information. As patients, why shouldn't you own your healthcare data? And third, clinical innovations. We know that there's only one solution to the following problem. How do you improve the quality of care, reduce expenditures, and preserve employment? There's only one answer to that challenge. You use a broader healthcare team where every member of the team is used to their fullest potential, to the limit of their license, so they're practicing at the top of their competencies, not at the bottom. So you have the physician as quarterback, point guard, if you will, since we're in Kentucky. You make sure that there's optimal use of all members of the team. We think that with this focus, we can reduce by 4 million the number of people who smoke and increase by 10 million the number of Americans whose blood pressure is under control. Those are measurable numbers that are going to require laser-like focus. Most of the work in tobacco control would be done in communities. Most of the work of hypertension control will be done in clinical settings. In tobacco control, we have things like hard-hitting ads, pricing of tobacco, smoke-free air, comprehensive programs. They work, and communities that implement them see their healthcare costs fall. They see their smoking rates fall. In the clinical sphere, we have blood pressure control and the potential to make a huge difference with reducing strokes, heart attacks, dialysis, kidney failure, eye problems, and a host of other health problems that come from high blood pressure. I also want to mention the epidemic of prescription drug overdose. Prescription opioids now kill more people than heroin and cocaine combined. 15,000 people a year. More emergency department visits than heroin and cocaine combined. There's been a fivefold rise in the number of deaths in the past 20 years, and a tenfold deaths in the number of prescriptions. In fact, enough opiates are prescribed each year to give every adult in America opiates every 4 hours around the clock for a month. This is a major problem. And we think we can do a lot about it. It's costly, but improving clinical practice, increasing access to substance abuse treatment, strengthening prescription drug monitoring programs, which your Congressman Hal Rogers has been instrumental in helping to create across the country, implementing patient review and restriction programs, leveraging insurer and pharmacy benefit managers, and enforcing laws, policies, and regulations can make a really big difference. In terms of both patients and providers, among those who are involved in opiates, you have those who are appropriately using, and we need to ensure palliation and appropriate care for people, for example, with intractable cancer pain. You have a second group of patients or physicians who may simply lack adequate training and information and be prescribing inappropriately or demanding inappropriately. Very interesting article last month in the Archives of Internal Medicine that looked at patient satisfaction and patient outcomes. More satisfied patients used more healthcare, used less emergency department visits, and died younger. It's not always the best thing to give patients everything they ask for, particularly if those are addictive substances. And then there are a very small number of patients and a very small number of doctors who are breaking the law and are doing this for profit and essentially are drug pushers. And for that, you need the appropriate law enforcement response. Hal Rogers has been really a leader in the fight against prescription drug overdose. He rang the alarm early, and he's been a leader in helping to get the programs up and running around the country. We need now to optimize them, implement them, and ensure that we can make them effective at confronting this epidemic. The failure of prevention costs money. As I said earlier, someone who's got obesity costs about $1,700 more to care for per year. A smoker costs about $2,600 more to care for per year, and someone with diabetes costs about $7,400 more to care for every year for the rest of their life. There are scalable interventions, and one word I want you to take away from this conference is scalability. Having an intervention that works great in a small group but is never going to get scaled up is not having an intervention that's going to do the kind of good it could do. The diabetes prevention program can reduce the risk of progression from pre-diabetes to diabetes by nearly 60%. Working with the Y, we've been able to drive down the cost from $2,000 to $400 to $500. And if you compare that with the $7,000 plus cost of diabetes care, you realize that this can be a cost-saving intervention. In fact, nationwide implementation of this would break even in about 14 years and provide billions of dollars of healthcare savings soon after that. Just to give an example from the past of fluoridation, fluoridation reduces dental caries substantially, saves about $20 for every dollar spent, and is highly effective to reduce costs. Folic acid is another area where there's been real progress. More than a one-third reduction in neural tube defects, preventing an estimated 10,000 children born with neural tube defects and saving more than $400 million in healthcare costs alone each year. We have more to do with neural tube defect prevention, particularly among Hispanic women, and we're working with a company which has just submitted its proposal to the Food and Drug Administration, which has to approve it, to fortify corn masa flour, which is more commonly used in Mexican-American communities and will result in a further decline in neural tube defects in that population. We need public health systems and services research. Prevention can improve health, reduce disease, and save money. We have many missed opportunities to improve health and save money in healthcare. We need to identify and document cost reductions, and we need to identify how we can deliver the strategies that we identify at the right time to the populations most in need in the right way every day, year round. The challenge is to identify the scalable interventions and then to scale them up. And doing that will require establishing feedback loops, figuring out what works, figuring out if we are going to scale, if we do have fidelity to the model, if we are achieving the impact that we are anticipating that we will achieve. I give the example of my experience as a health commissioner in a large city where we implemented tobacco control interventions, we increased the tobacco tax, smoking went down. We increased, we implemented Smoke-Free Air Act, smoking went down. We then thought our job was done. But smoking then didn't go down anymore. We had a stall. So we said, what else can we do? We ran hard-hitting ads, and again, we saw a dramatic decline in smoking. If we hadn't had that feedback loop, we wouldn't have known that we needed to do something different. We wouldn't have achieved the results we did. And when we were criticized for spending that kind of money on hard-hitting ads, we wouldn't have been able to defend them. But I was able, because of the information systems that we had, I was able to say under oath that I was confident that the ads that we were running were saving at least 1,500 lives for every $1 million we spent. And I think the life of one of our fellow citizens is certainly worth the modest, modest investment that that represents. So bridging the implementation gap is the challenge for health services research and for public health research. We have knowledge and technologies, things that we know work, and we have the ability to implement. But what we all too often lack is the connection between those two things. We have an implementation gap. The gap between what we know and what we wish we knew is huge, but it's much smaller than the gap between what we know and what we do. And that's the challenge of all of us working in implementation research, health systems research, and public health implementation, because ultimately there should be no gap between program and analysis. It's not a question of analyzing over here and running a program over here. A well-run program must have an inbuilt feedback loop to figure out if it's working so we can defend and extend programs that work and fix them if they're not. Thank you very much.